Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup around the country, the leaked draft opinion indicating the Supreme Court might overturn Roe v. Wade is like a missile strike. Now people around the country are scurrying to figure out what it may mean, and we look at North and South Carolina. City Council considers a big budget, but no property tax hike. Still, you may miss free parking on Saturdays uptown, while an audit of cats has some on council concerned. Madison Cawthorn just cannot stay out of the news, and it's all bad what this means as voting in the primary is underway. School Board Chair Elise Dashew talks about the former superintendent, and Charlotte-Mecklenburg parks are still among the worst in the country. Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE health reporter Claire Donnelly. Good morning, Claire.
Good morning.
Joe Bruno is back, comfortably ensconced in the nice mahogany-paneled conference room at WSOC-TV, where he reports on a regular basis. Good morning to you.
Hello, Mike.
Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast, author of the book behind her, for those of you watching this on Facebook, which is on Remainder, I guess, at Amazon. She's very upset about that. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and thanks for the dubious shout-out.
And the book is called Politics in the what?
Covering Politics in the Age of Trump. It's 24 top political journalists and their take.
Okay. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Mike.
So the entire country has been galvanized and talking about the historic leak that occurred this week at the Supreme Court in a draft of a forthcoming opinion. It appears that the court, with its solidly conservative majority, is more than open to overturning what many consider to be a settled law. And if you heard the hearings that brought in three new justices, they appeared to be okay with that being settled law, the right to an abortion as specified by the court's Roe v. Wade decision. But Elon University's Tom Maloney stressed to WSOC-TV that this is a draft. It is not final.
It was drafted and circulated, the draft says, in February of this year. And who knows exactly how the final opinion will look.
But Claire, if this decision goes through, it could essentially throw decisions on abortion rights back to the states. So what might that mean for North and South Carolina?
Right. So there are two sort of null laws right now, dormant laws that could take effect, one in South Carolina, one in North Carolina. The North Carolina law has been on the books since 1973, but hasn't been enforceable. And that would ban abortions after 20 weeks. In South Carolina, they passed recently this heartbeat bill, which would effectively ban abortions after 6 weeks. Governor Henry McMaster in South Carolina has said, you know, he wants to go even further. So it will kind of depend on what the final opinion rules.
And the governor has said, Joe, that any attempt by our legislature, he would veto. But there is this danger of a supermajority of Republicans being elected in the fall, which would negate his ability to do that. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's accurate. Every state lawmaker is on the ballot right now, and November will decide. So if anti-abortion people win enough races, they'll take away the governor's veto power, and then we may see some of those laws that we're seeing in South Carolina and other southern states.
Reaction to all of this has been unbelievable around the country, not just at the Supreme Court. This would be heading to all 50 states to make a decision. Many of them already have. North Carolina Governor Roy Cooper said, now more than ever, governors and state legislatures must stand up for women's health care. We know the stakes and must stand firm to protect a woman's choice and access to medical care. Do we know what, if anything, South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster has had to say about this?
I think he would. I mean, I think anti-abortion rights activists were galvanized by this draft opinion. I know Henry McMaster said, you know, he would consider bringing state lawmakers back for a special session to pass an even stricter abortion restriction law. So we'll just have to see if that comes to pass.
Mary, there are those who say that this is all posturing, that the people who are saying the more reasonable, conservative, more moderate Republicans are saying, yes, we must do this. They really don't want to do this. It removes for them a key issue that's been with them for years. But also they know what kind of a firestorm they are unleashing. Would that be accurate?
Very accurate. I believe on the show yesterday, you talked about, you know, they caught the car. You know, you saw this with the Affordable Care Act. It was an issue that run against, but when they had the power, they didn't actually repeal it because polls had turned and showed that a lot of people liked it. It's the same thing with the abortion issue. They have been running on it, and Donald Trump said he would only appoint justices that would repeal Roe. A lot of folks did not believe it. They said, oh, this is established, particularly since those justices said it was established law, but we see that they meant what they said. And you can see it in the sense that Republicans really do not want to talk about the substance of the draft. They want to say, they don't want to talk about the fact that it was leaked. And they have already put out talking points about it because they don't want to appear cruel. So they are talking more about compassion, where the actual substance of what they are doing in these states, say in Louisiana, where a Republican has put forth legislation that would charge a woman who had an abortion and the doctor who performed it with homicide, that this is tough. Polls show, I mean, and it's complicated because it depends on the trimester, but in general, Americans want to keep it legal. And also we realize in many of these states, they haven't expanded Medicaid. So who's gonna pay for the healthcare?
Yeah.
You know, family leave. This is not the end of abortion. Women with means will always be able to travel to another state or another country. This is going to fall disproportionately on the poor. And for people, particularly young people who don't remember or haven't read much about pre-Roe America, where it wasn't that there were fewer abortions, but that they were illegal. Many of them put women in health jeopardy. And we already have really terrible percentages when it comes to the world in maternal mortality, particularly with poor women. So Republicans at this point, it's so interesting. You see that they really realize that this is an issue that can not only energize their base, but energize the base of the Democrats and the people who did not believe that this would ever happen.
There are also a lot of people saying that this is indicative that the court has become a political body. Some have gone as far as to say as another arm of the Republican Party and part of the minority in the country. But when you look back on just what you just said about Donald Trump promising to appoint judges who would overturn Roe, he did, they probably will. Isn't that testament to the fact that it's always been a political body?
Of course it has always been a political body. And we see this, we can go back hundreds of years. And it's just that people have been losing confidence in it. And the fact of the leak and this ruling proves that, you know, it's becoming less and less legitimate. It is not this body on high. But yes, it has always been political. And, you know, for hundreds of years, you have had, when Samuel Alito talks about rights that weren't enumerated in the Constitution, and he looks askance at rights that were given in the second part of the 20th century, well, I'm an African-American woman. I wasn't, none of my rights were enumerated in the Constitution. There were a handful of white males who drafted this document. So is there no surprise that women weren't mentioned and these rights weren't mentioned? And you also see people saying, well, if this is the reasoning, and if you've read I encourage everybody to read a piece of at least some of Alito's draft, because a lot of it isn't legalese. It sounds like a man on a mission. And he also, remember, voted against the legality of same-sex marriage. Many of the Republicans talk about outlawing contraception. And if you use the reasoning in this, they could go after many rights. And so a lot of people are also seeing this as laying the groundwork for more to come. And for those who would say, well, they'd never go after interracial marriage and contraception and same-sex marriage. Well, many people said they'd never go after Roe v. Wade.
Right. Eric, did you want to jump in there?
I just wanted to add something. What Joe mentioned earlier in the show in terms of the state legislature and they're all on the ballot, the Republican, to get to a supermajority, they need 72 in the House. They need 30 in the Senate. Right now, there are 69 Republicans in the House. So they need three more seats and they need two more in the Senate. So that just goes to show you how galvanizing this issue is likely to be in the fall.
This issue has so many tentacles in so many areas. It will have, it will be an earthquake if this happens in so many different ways. And Joe, you spoke with Johnson C. Smith political scientist Dr. Tirsa Lima-Nevis, who told you that we should prepare for this to impact our politics.
I think if this drags on to November, and the abortion ban does go into effect, this will be a major issue in North Carolina.
And NBC reported yesterday that the potential for this reversal has some national Republicans worried about what the impact might be on the November election. Do you see it impacting our primaries here or the general election here, in which U.S. House seats are up for grabs? One United States Senator seat is up for grabs, and there are numerous legislative positions up for grabs.
Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about Republicans being pro-life, but there are some Democrats who are abortion opponents, and they are in primaries right now. One race that catches my eye is Erica Smith versus Don Davis in the 1st Congressional District. Don Davis is a more conservative Democrat and has in the past voted for anti-choice legislation that Erica Smith has been endorsed by abortion rights groups. So that, I think, is a race in North Carolina that has a lot of attention on it because of this issue. Democrats, the fundraising after this leaked draft did not really compare to when RGB passed away. So I do think that this will be an issue in the local races, maybe the congressional races. We'll see just how huge it does become, though, especially in some of these Senate races.
Mary.
I do also think that it does, to add on what Joe said, has implications for the national races, for the Senate races, because if this happens, and we know that Democrats are holding on to very slim majorities in the Congress, maybe the Congress, if it flips to Republicans, will want to have a federal ban to actually counteract some of the states like Colorado and Connecticut that are even leaning in harder for abortion rights. And that is a possibility as well. We know how slim that is. So even the Senate races, and we've already seen Ted Budd and Sherry Beasley come out with very different positions. So this is going to have implications up and down the ballot.
You were on earlier this week, you were on WHUR out of Washington, also on Sirius XM, a show called The Daily Drum, in which you said, we don't live in a theocracy. And that is true. But our politics appear to be moving toward autocracy. Is theocracy a component of that?
Well, you know, I was a little bit transparent because I'm Catholic. I write columns. People know this. And yes, you know, I have certain beliefs, but I felt that I don't have the right to put them on other people in the country. But you do see in the Republican Party in particular, this issue of white Christian nationalism. It's been written about quite a bit. And yes, the religion is a piece of that. And I think you can say that that's legitimate because Donald Trump, his most fervent supporters were white evangelicals who put aside his personal peccadilloes, this thrice married, person who is certainly, you know, with a leaked tape about grabbing women, but because he promised to put these anti-abortion judges on the Supreme Court. And they are actually now the base of the Republican Party. And we've seen that up and down the ballot as well.
We have to take a break. Coming back with more on abortion, on the elections, and on the city budget, and more on Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and the local news roundup. Claire Donnelly is here. She's our healthcare reporter. Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, and Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call and host of their Equal Time podcast. No matter where you stand on this abortion issue, this would be yet another example of minority rule over the majority. The majority of Americans, by almost every poll I've ever seen, believe that abortion should be legal, as does a woman by the name of Heather Mobley. She's a board member of Charlotte for Choice, and here is what she told Channel 9.
Abortion is safe. It is a normal procedure. It is health care. Right now, it's still legal. Making it illegal is not going to stop abortion. It's going to make it harder for people.
But there is the other side of this. They were just as surprised, but more delighted, shall we say, by the possible reversal of Roe.
That is fantastic news, and I am so glad and grateful.
That's Izzy Hernandez, a mother who had previous abortions, but was talked out of one at an abortion clinic by a Christian support group, and it set her on a different course. She now works with an anti-abortion group. Do we know anybody where the majority of North Carolinians stand on this issue? Nationally, there's support for keeping it. What about in North Carolina?
I haven't seen recent polling on the issue. And it really, abortion hasn't been the most pressing issue in recent elections. I think obviously that's going to change now, but candidates weren't really running on this the past few cycles.
I did just want to throw out too, when we were talking about the politics, that it's interesting to note that neither leader in the North Carolina State House has really come out with anything that I've seen. Tim Moore and Phil Berger have been largely quiet on that. So that's interesting.
Mary.
And I did want to mention, when it comes to the polls, even nationally, overwhelming support in the first trimester, the support lessens in the second and third, although the majority of abortions in the United States do happen in the first trimester. And Mike, when you talked about minority rule, I do want to point out also that five justices on the Supreme Court, Roberts, Alito, and Kavanaugh, Gorsuch, and Coney Barrett, were all appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote. Yeah. And I'm not saying that the Supreme Court should go along with the popularity of what the issue is, but that's just an interesting aside.
Well, and the last three justices were appointed by a twice impeached president who also lost the popular vote and then lost his bid for re-election.
And Gorsuch was the seat stolen from Obama, and Justice Coney Barrett was placed when Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, when voting had already started.
I want to move on from this issue in a second, but because we're going to do a whole hour on this on Monday. But Claire, we should touch on what the impact of this may be for North Carolina taxpayers and the North Carolina healthcare system, because if other states around us outlaw it and we don't, that means a lot of people will be flooding into our state to seek the services they can't get where they are. And if we make this illegal, then what do we do about the women who can't afford prenatal care because they simply don't have the money? What do we do once these children are born to parents who don't want them or can't care for them, which is why they would have sought the abortion in the first place? Has anybody talked about it? Has anybody prepared for it? Are we prepared?
I think there's a lot of concern about the flood. As you said, you know, there's a possibility that North Carolina would be the closest state for a lot of folks in the South. If North Carolina passes a stricter than 20-week ban, North Carolinians, South Carolinians, everybody in the South, the closest location might be Washington, D.C., which obviously is about a six-hour drive from Charlotte. So there is a lot of concern that there would be a flood of patients.
Yeah. Joe?
Yeah, just real quick. In September, when Texas enacted a ban on abortions at the 6 week of pregnancy, Planned Parenthood clinics in Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma saw a 2,500% increase in patients from Texas. access.
Okay, well, more on this on Monday, and they'll be also talking about this in the next hour on the on 1A's National News Roundup. Early voting for the May 17th primary is underway. Donald Trump endorsed Representative Ted Budd, leading the Republican pack of candidates. But other candidates in the race have condemned the spending on Budd's campaign put forth by the Republican pack Club for Growth. I think they've spent $8 million to support him in the primary. They plan to spend $14 million by Election Day. Is this just sour grapes on behalf of the other candidates?
I don't know if it's sour grapes, but it's certainly typical, let's say that, because these Senate races in North Carolina, I think 2014 and 2020 were both record breakers nationally. And this is following the same pattern, which is a ton of national money coming in. And I think your point resonates, Mike, because I don't think any of the other candidates would have turned down the $8 million that's going Ted Budd's way.
Well, it's also nothing compared to what they spent in Ohio. I don't know that the Club for Growth spent this in Ohio, but in winning that senatorial primary, the Republican candidate there, J.D. Vance, they spent $80 million on television advertising in a primary. Wow. What has turnout been like, Joe, so far in early voting?
Most of the ballots have been Republican, which I would expect for unaffiliated voters to breaking towards Republicans right now, because that is the more interesting race. Sherry Beasley has the Democratic race locked up. Here in Mecklenburg County, it's been slow, hovering around 10,000, 12,000 votes so far. We're only getting 1,500 to 2,000 votes a day. So it's going to be one of those low turnout races for Mecklenburg County, but all eyes are on that Senate race.
Do you anticipate things heating up? Because this has been a very quiet Senate race for the most part. And the fate of the Senate depends on what happens in November. It's a 50-50 split right now. One more senator and the whole thing could turn. Are Democrats making hay while the sun shines in North Carolina, or are they just sitting back and waiting for November?
They're sitting back, and I think it's fair to question whether that is the right move. Sherry Beasley is on television introducing herself to voters, but largely she has stayed quiet and let Ted Budd and Pat McCrory battle it out.
Mary?
Yeah, you can feel that Ted Budd is feeling the wind at his back after looking at Ohio and seeing the Trump-endorsed candidate shoot to the front of the pack, J.D. Vance. The thing of it is Ohio just like North Carolina? But there's going to be a lot of money in it, as you said. I do think I agree with Joe that Sherry Beasley is going to have to step it up. Her commercials are very low-key. And this is going to be another one that, you know, North Carolina, we are pretty split when it comes to, we're a purple state. So we'll see a lot of national interest, and I expect a lot of appearances by national figures. We already see Higher Heights, which is an organization that supports, minority women, and Emily's List, which supports pro-choice women candidates, tiptoeing in. So we'll have some national interest on that side as well.
Sure. And I'm curious what the national spend is going to be. What is the investment going to be in this race for North Carolina? Sherry Beasley is doing a nice job outraising the Republican opponents, but there's going to be a ton of cash in this race. And are these national groups going to back Sherry Beasley when they're on the fence in Georgia, Nevada, New Hampshire, Arizona, so many races that Democrats are just trying to keep their seats in addition to picking up this one in North Carolina?
Yeah. Yet it seems at some point they might pull out if they feel that this is not a race to be won.
Well, that means that was a mistake, a bad calculation on the part of Democrats, because it seems to me that the reason Jeff Jackson pulled out of that race is because the National Democratic Party thought that Sherry Beasley would be the stronger candidate. Would that be accurate to say? So if that's true, then they made a miscalculation if something doesn't pump up the thing by November. The Charlotte City Council began considering their proposed $3.2 billion budget for 2023, which includes raises for employees and one-time bonuses for those workers, as well as funding for training and educational opportunities. These raises come in two tiers. Talk about them, Joe, Eric. I don't know which one to ask about this. Talk about those raises and the bonuses and how large the proposed raises are and who would get them.
Let me wrap that up in 10 seconds.
Okay.
the biggest push is with hourly workers, and I should start from the beginning, which is we've heard a lot of protesting and criticism from city employees about work conditions and about pay, and this budget is largely a response to that. The hourly workers would go up by 8%, but they get a one-time 2% of their salary bonus, a minimum of $1,000. So that's the biggest piece of this, or the largest raise, I should say. Executive staff would not receive that one-time bonus. There also are 4% raises for salary workers. Public safety employees would get higher than normal raises in their respective tiers, and healthcare costs would stay the same. So those are the kind of the headlines on the pay piece of it.
And City Manager Marcus Jones, who will be on this program next Wednesday along with Mayor Lyles, is also requesting money for anti-violence outreach programs, improvements like lighting and signals for pedestrian and auto safety, and investments in disadvantaged neighborhoods. Has he been more specific than that, or do I have to wait till Wednesday?
I think you have to wait till Wednesday, and okay. I'll just say kudos on landing the city manager for an interview. I've interviewed Mike Pence more than I've interviewed Marcus Jones.
And he's been here many times, Marcus. Not Mike Pence. He's not been here.
Yeah, he's so still running.
That's right. So, well, he was in South Carolina yesterday. Wasn't he in Fort Mill or Rock Hill?
Rock Hill.
For the prayer. Yeah. Right.
They are looking at doubling the funds for affordable housing over the next couple of years, but no property taxes have been proposed. That's good news, but here's the caveat. Get ready for those fees to rise. Which fees and by how much?
So typically we always see a Charlotte Water, Stormwater, and Solid Waste Services fees rise during the budget. It's about $3 more a month for the average homeowner. But the big one that got a lot of attention is the parking fee, because we haven't adjusted this since 1997. And parking is really easy and low maintenance in Charlotte, as we all know. The parking fee would rise from $1 an hour to $1.50 an hour, and you will no longer be able to park for free on Saturdays. This impacts street parking mainly in Uptown and South End.
Yeah, and actually when you think about $1.50 to park in many of those lots downtown, it's $20 for 15 minutes or $5. It depends on where you are, I suppose. What has been the reaction on council to these various proposals in the budget so far?
It was pretty positive. I mean, most of what I heard of people I talked to seemed largely to like what the city manager has proposed. I don't think that means there won't be changes. There will be changes. Dimple Ejmira was one who said parking might be one of the areas that they look at. And I would say that's probably the one that's going to get the most attention.
A big story going forward is we're starting to see a little bit of pushback from Tark Bakari on the affordable housing bond. He thinks that the city keeps throwing money at this problem and they're not making any progress. So he has already said that he is not going to be in favor of the bonds this year. We haven't really seen pushback to that $50 million from a city council member, really from the community. And I think over the next couple of weeks during this budget process, and then as we get toward the election in November, we're going to see more of that play out.
I know that Mary wants to jump in, but before she does, going back to Tarek Bakari, he's the person largely responsible for the extensive slate of Republican candidates running for city council in a Democratic city. And one of the things that they have harped on is that you've had Democrats in control for so long, we still have crime and we still have an affordable housing problem. So give us a shot. Does he have an alternative proposal?
He wants to view affordable housing as a tool when it comes to improving upward mobility. There's frustrations over how a number of units that has not reduced that the city needs. And I think there's also going to be more of a push from home ownership. But what I haven't heard clearly communicated yet is how the solution is voting no to the $50 million as opposed to getting the $50 million and advocating for change once you have it. So these are the things that we'll be asking and waiting to see more details on.
Mary.
Yeah, just briefly that I think Republicans like Beccari see that in a year that perhaps might be a way for Republicans that they can make inroads without a lot of plans of what they're going to do, but just running on the fact that we're not those guys and, yeah. You know, give us a shot. And when it comes to the parking too, I think people are thinking, you know, Charlotte needs to up the minimum wage and also up its public transportation options before we start taking away.
Well, I'm glad you brought up public transportation because Charlotte City Council also got a look at the city audit, which has raised some concerns about Charlotte area transportation system. This involves money Katz raised through transit advertising that was to go toward making transportation cheaper. Evidently, some of that money is what? Missing?
Potentially. Well, yeah, and this deals with all the advertisements you see on the side of buses and light rail vehicles. And when the city signed a deal with this third party, they were promised a guarantee of like $7 million in revenue plus a share of anything excess. And when the pandemic hit, they realized there was some different interpretations of the agreement. So there's a couple problems here. One, is the city missing any money? This third party says no. Charlotte isn't so convinced. Two, why did it take a global pandemic to realize this was happening? And three, you know, what are you going to do in the future to make sure you can account for all of the funds that
so you are entitled to? So the way this works, they contracted out with Vector. They're the company that is the third party that sells advertising, and they share this. But they're promised a certain number of advertising impressions. And if you take buses off the street during a pandemic because nobody's going anywhere, then there are fewer impressions. Therefore, the money changes. And Vector issued a statement saying, to be clear, Vector is certain that it does not owe any unpaid funds to Katz, and goes on to say that they have, quote, been in discussion with Katz, and as part of these discussions, we are also assessing the extent to which Vector may, in fact, be owed certain amounts under the contract due to the city's periodic reduction in service. Now, this did result in concerns being expressed on council. Councilwoman Dimple Ajmera finds this worrisome.
As a certified public accountant, I am concerned that revenue could be used for other things that we need.
And Councilman Tariq Beccari worries that this could be just the tip of the iceberg and questions whether a major overhaul is needed.
I am incredibly, incredibly concerned. The Katz audit doesn't look good. Is it time for us to seriously contemplate changing the way we approach and structure and operate Katz?
Okay, so I got 30 seconds. Is he alone in that opinion, or are others on board? And is this just politics? Election year politics?
No, these are legitimate concerns. Okay. It was one of the more concerning audits that the city has produced. But good on the auditors for catching this.
Okay. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more. We got we get to talk about Madison Cawthorn again. As you pointed out, we used to have a tip jar for whenever we brought up HB2. Eric, we're going to institute that tip jar for Madison. When we come back, it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE. We're here with Claire Donnelly, WFAE's healthcare reporter, Mary C. Curtis, columnist for Roll Call and host of their Equal Time podcast. Eric Spanberg is joining us. He's the managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Joe Bruno, reporter extraordinaire for WSOC-TV Channel 9. City Council, before we move on, City Council held a work session this week to talk about rules that would affect what property owners can do with their property. This should be fun. This is part of the comprehensive 2040 plan that was so controversial last year. What are some of the restrictions that they are considering?
I think that one of the big ones that's getting a lot of attention is whether you need permits to cut as a homeowner to cut down trees in your yard, and what size and state they would be in if you had to do that. Other cities have done that. That came up this week. Also, talk about the duplexes and triplexes. You remember there was the whole fight about what can be built in neighborhoods? So would there be limits on the sidewalls? And I would say those are two of the ones that are going to get a lot more attention.
Yeah, the tree requirement, they're considering requiring a permit to remove a tree larger than 30 inches in diameter, and there may be requirements after that that you replant a tree in place of it, because we're trying to protect our tree canopy. So we'll watch that unfold in the coming weeks as they move from work session to open sessions on this. Well, the time has come. Let's all put a quarter in the tip jar. U.S. House District incumbent and Republican candidate for the North Carolina 11th District, Madison Cawthorn, just cannot stay out of the news. I don't even know where to begin. This list has grown so fast. He's been cited for driving, I think, with an expired license or expired tags. Either way, they yanked his license. He's been cited for trying to carry loaded guns onto airplanes, I think at least twice. He's taken knives into meetings where weapons are prohibited. He's accused colleagues of inviting him to orgies that are cocaine-fueled. He's called Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky a thug. Senator Tom Tillis has called for a congressional ethics investigation into Cawthorn for alleged insider trading. There are people working right now to deny him an opportunity to be reelected under the terms of the 14th Amendment because of his possible association with the January 6th insurrection. And the 14th Amendment essentially prohibits people who have been in rebellion against the United States from holding office at that level. Many of these are self-inflicted wounds, but
that was quite a scroll, Mike.
I'm not even. I could keep going, but I don't think I want to.
Didn't even get into the videos.
Yeah, yeah. The video this week. Yeah, that was the news of the week.
Yes, there have been clips and him wearing lingerie and him in a compromising sexual position, which is floating around. He says these were just pranks. And that they are hits against him. Fake news, a drip campaign, but that blackmail won't win. I have news for Mr. Cawthorn. When there is video, it is not fake. So what are we to make of all this?
It's a consistent pattern. I mean, it's a consistent pattern. And I guess the question is, will that affect him in the primary? Or if he survives the primary, will it affect him in the general election? He's got, what, seven? Mary, you know, he's got seven Republican opponents in the primary.
Yeah, and Tom Tillis, who is a sitting senator, Republican, has come out against him and supported him, which is very unusual to come out against an incumbent. But, you know, it's another case of you get the voters put him in there. He was young. He had a very sketchy resume. And he pretty much promised that he really wasn't there to do much legislating. He put all of his money more into his communications team to become this figure. So they are getting who they put in there. And I think the test will be, if he does survive all this, it will be a tribute to the strength of just pure partisanship and pure tribalism.
Well, I asked this question, I think it was yesterday, I can't remember, of political scientist Susan Roberts from Davidson College. And the question is this: what does it say that we have reached a point in our politics that a candidate and office holder with a litany of peccadilloes, any one of which would have destroyed, and in fact, in the past, have destroyed political careers? What does it mean that you can survive this? What does it mean about us? Not about him, us.
It means the truth doesn't matter, that actions don't have consequences. For the party of personal responsibility, no one takes responsibility. They will say one thing, deny it, and when the proof comes, deny it again. But the thing of it is, he does have an opponent, a Democratic opponent, Katie Dean, who is saying, I will work, she has a plan, but there will be people who will rather vote for the R than the D, no matter what. That's what it says about us.
It's just an unprecedented amount of opposition research that is being dumped on a candidate, and not by Democrats in this. These leaks are coming from his former friends, people in the Republican Party, people who used to work for him. And my question is, at what point does President Trump say this is too much? He is his highest profile endorser And I think of all the leaks that have not yet surfaced and things that have come up in the past, the biggest thing that would hurt him at this point is Trump putting out a statement saying, I'm withdrawing my endorsement.
But when Trump came, you realized he saw who was sitting right beside him.
He spoke at that rally on April 9th. Madison
Absolutely. Park. But, you know, Bo Hines was also there. He's the congressional district candidate in Johnson County, and he's starting to distance himself from Madison Cawthorn now, saying, oh, the only thing we have in common is we're both young and conservative. We're different people. I don't agree with him on everything. So Trump's distanced himself from people in the past. The candidate and Mo Brooks in Mississippi comes to mind.
Alabama.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, is he shaking his head in Mar-a-Lago right now?
Donald Trump comes to mind when you talk about things like this. Come on. Getting back to the challenges against his candidacy, the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia was scheduled to have held hearings this past Tuesday in which plaintiffs are attempting to use an 1872 law that would disqualify anybody serving in Congress from serving in Congress who participated in a rebellion against the United States. And many would argue that January 6th was that, and they are suspicious of his behind-the-scenes activities in that. Do we know what happened in that hearing?
That whole case is such a long shot. If you want to remove Madison Cawthorn, vote in the May 17th primary and then again in the general election if he wins.
Okay.
Yeah, he's also using a 19th century law to defend himself that, you know, pro-Confederates were forgiven. So it seems a little interesting that he is aligning himself with those folks. But yeah, on brand.
So just 2 weeks ago, the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board fired the latest superintendent, Ernest Winston. When they made the announcement, Board Chair Elise Dashew spoke about how it pained her to take this step, given Winston's love for the system and his past contributions. But this week, she shared some of the concerns that led to that dismissal with WFAE's education reporter, Andos Helms. She acknowledged that the board bears some of the blame for the shortcomings of Winston's superintendency. When they hired him, she said they knew of his lack of experience, but that he and the board had agreed that he would need coaching to grow into the job.
And I trusted and believed that he would develop those skills that were needed. And I think there were folks in the community who were watching us who weren't trusting that, and they were right. I was wrong.
Wow. When's the last time you heard that? She mentioned several examples that were red flags. Were they based, Claire, on academic performance during his tenure or how he performed as an administrator?
Yeah, I think more how he performed as an administrator. Like you said, they were hoping, you know, the board was hoping that he would, you know, sort of learn on the job, as it were. And I guess now they are taking responsibility that did not happen.
Hmm. Although Winston had no experience as a superintendent in previous districts, he had spent 15 years here as a teacher and central office staffer. And Elise Dashew believed that the qualities he developed in those positions were qualities that were needed in the superintendent.
Integrity, compassion, commitment to the district, a true love for the kids and the employees of CMS.
So whether the board believed he succeeded or failed in the job, did he display those qualities while he held that job? Do we know?
I don't know the answer.
I view him as of a man of very high character in my dealings with him. It wasn't always easy to cover him or the school board, but no one ever questioned whether he loved his job and loved what he was doing for these kids.
Yeah. And I felt that they felt that he saw what some of the problems were, but he was very indecisive in solving them. And you know, particularly when it comes to reacting to very, very hot button things like the sexual assault issues in the schools and other things, that his inexperience caused him to be very tentative.
And evidently that was a complaint of his staff. And I think Hugh Hadebaugh, the interim superintendent who has the job now, made reference to that when he said he was going to break the backlog or something like that. I'm paraphrasing here coming in. get things moving, I guess. Meanwhile, we know that CMS will be going to the county to ask for $578.4 million toward the system's $2.1 billion budget for next year. Last year, the commission wanted more details on how CMS intended to fix student performance, and the board refused to give those details to the commission, saying they run the schools, not the commission. It's their business, not theirs. So it went to mediation. School board won. They got the money. Now another battle may be brewing over teaching kids to read, and it involves a public-private initiative called Read Charlotte. What is this about?
You know, it's a third-party program to help boost reading scores, and you know, there's just such a level of unsatisfaction with where things are in CMS at this moment, that some CMS leaders and some county leaders are wondering whether we are going to see a repeat of last year, despite CMS coming out as the winners in the battle last year. There's still just a lot of escalation and war of words. If you read Ann Doss Helms's story on this topic and Read Charlotte, there's a quote at the bottom of it from Vilma Leek during a meeting where she said that she thinks that parents should be able to go out and get a warrant and arrest the teachers for not properly educating children. That doesn't sound like a comment from a person, an elected official who expects things to be nice and smooth during this budget process.
Evidently, the Read Charlotte, they advocate for adopting A2I, assessment to instruction, as the answer to help younger students read. And CMS says, yeah, it's one of many answers. Right. There's lots of products out there. So that's part of the disagreement. Former Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox, who went to Washington during the Obama administration to be the Secretary of Transportation, is now being considered to head the White House Office of Public Engagement. What would that job entail, and why do they see Fox as a good fit, Mary?
Well, I interviewed on my podcast Cedric Richmond, who was an experienced legislator who had that job. And this is going to be very important, public engagement. With the midterms coming up, they need somebody savvy. They need somebody with connections, particularly to work on outreach and engagement with the diverse minority communities and to have them really be enthusiastic about showing up for the midterms. The survival of the party's majorities depend on it. And I think they feel that Anthony Fox, well, this is an Axios reporting and it hasn't been named yet. But it makes sense that his name floats to the top.
But this would be the head of the White House Office of Public Engagement. What you just described sounds political, and I thought that the White House was not supposed to be political.
Getting out the White House message on what they have done. That's what Cedric Richmond did when he was on my show, just sort of pointing out these are some policies of the White House. This is what's happening, and I just think they need them to resonate from someone who has that experience.
It's really engaging.
But of course, nothing is ever, it's engagement. This is not at all political, Mike. You know that.
Okay. On Wednesday, CMPD announced the arrest of a former professional skateboarder here accused of using his role to sexually assault children, both boys and girls. 51-year-old Wayne Ray Goff was arrested on 10 warrants of indecent liberties with a minor. His alleged offenses date back to the 1990s, I think 1993 to be exact. Are there any more recent allegations? And if they date back to the 90s, what took them so long?
You know, it's everybody has their own journey when they're involved in things like this. And eventually it got to the point where someone felt like they wanted to come forward and shed light on what this man allegedly did. The CMPD is looking for information right now. Now that they identified this former skateboarder as a person of interest, as someone who's charged with this, to find out if he did this to anyone else. And we did talk to a skateboard shop owner who said three of the victims confided to him about this. So this seems to have been a known secret in the skateboarding community of Charlotte.
So Eric, you get to choose the last story, either the search for the new Hornets head coach or the fact that our parks are still near the bottom.
Let's talk about the parks.
Okay.
That ties into the tree ordinance with the UDO.
We are improving, but we ranked 95th 2 years ago, 91st last year. This year, 83rd of the top
100. We're 83rd.
Yes, yes.
It's about access. Everybody doesn't have equal access. It's the story of Charlotte, equality, equity.
Much of this is based on a 10-minute walk to a park, right?
Yes, absolutely. And one of the things that was interesting, Mike, is they did praise Charlotte actually for investing more in greenways and trails and said that Charlotte has a chance to keep moving up. So we'll see if that improvement continues next year.
Okay. And Claire, Mecklenburg County has experienced 7 weeks of stable or decreasing COVID activity, but now that's changing. Things are going up. Is that right? Very quickly. 10 seconds.
Yes,
less than that.
That's right. Yes, we don't know by how much, okay. But yes.
Or why. Claire Donnelly from WFAE, Joe Bruner from WSOC-TV, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and the Equal Time Podcast, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. Thanks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.